Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm coming to you straight from a Regis office in the heart of San Francisco. And one of the things that I love about the city is that people are not afraid to take on big competition, not afraid to have these big goals. And today's guest is someone who I've admired for not just his ability to take on a big competitor, but to actually keep doing well. And I've just been freaking baffled, and I'm so excited that I get to interview him today. His name is Jerry Hum. He runs a site called Touch of Modern. How many people have you seen with a Shopify site that have wished that they were going to do e-commerce well and they were going to sell and get people to come to their website? And in reality, they can't get people to come to their site, which is a real challenge. And if I ask them what their numbers are, they'll tell me high revenue, but they'll also quietly tell me that most of it comes from selling on Amazon and that they're not making any money there. Meanwhile, Jerry Hum comes in after failing twice, has the nerve to come in with an e-commerce site in a world that feels like Amazon's dominating all of e-commerce, has not just the nerve to come in and do it, but to succeed in it. And to succeed in it with these products that I don't even know how to describe them. He gave me a sentence to describe his company that's, here's what he gave me. It was something like, e-commerce site focused on discovery of unique and noteworthy products. I could say that all day long. You won't really understand it until you go to his freaking website and see that he's selling a flamethrower that you can shoot from your wrist. So it's kind of an interesting site, but still, I'm really baffled, Jerry, by how you do this. I invited you here to find out how you keep growing, how you get all these sales, and I can do it thanks to two sponsors. The first is a company that helps me hire phenomenal developers. It's called TopTal, and the second is a company that I rent office space from. It's called Regis. I'll tell you guys about them later. Jerry, good to have you here.
Hey, good to be here. Thanks for that.
You know what? People are going to think, I think our connection just broke down there. There we go. People are going to think that I'm exaggerating. Why don't we start with your revenue? What was your revenue last year, 2017?
It's about $120
million. $120
million.
And why? I told you I don't understand this. I looked on your site. I found a couple of products to compare, earphones on your site for other sites. I don't see a huge price difference. I'm trying to figure out what is the thing that brings people to Touch of Modern and gets them to buy. Why do people buy from you? What draws them to your site? What's the thing that gets you over $100 million in annual sales?
Yeah, so I'll start from kind of the premise of where we started, right? And you know, 2012, when we kind of transitioned from our previous businesses to Touch of Modern, we took a look at some of the other e-commerce players out there at the time, and we found that most folks were kind of building and online outlet for the kind of things we find in department stores. And remember the founders and I, the other three guys, we were kind of sitting in the living room and we had this discussion about who made the best speakers. And our CTO has all this technical knowledge and kind of made his argument for the best speakers. And we were all like, okay, obviously, you know more than we do about this topic and we'll kind of concede to you, to your choice, right? And we realized that each of us have this obsession or hobby that we always feel like, you know, we're the most knowledgeable person in the room about. And we do a ton of research before we buy anything, related to those hobbies. And we often spend more than a typical person would, you know, after we've done research on those things, right? And, you know, for example, I'm an architect and I was an architect. And at the time I would spend a lot on furniture and things and save up for it, even though, you know, most people my age were buying IKEA furniture, right? We have Dennis, who's really into, you know, motorcycles and fishing and, you know, outdoor activities, and John, who's into, kitchen and cooking and all that kind of stuff, right? And so there wasn't really a destination for people like us who took the time to do the research and would buy from not necessarily like brands that were plastered all over the malls, but, you know, things that really appeal to the enthusiasts, right? Things you'd have to read up on the forums about to kind of find out why something like this costs more. Because to us, something that was worth it was not something that was cheap, but something that was like a good value for the money, even though the price tag might be a bit higher.
But still, so I can see that you guys have really nice earphone collections on your site. Couldn't somebody still go and find them at Amazon, do research on blogs, do research online, and then go buy it at Amazon?
So that's funny that you asked that, because actually the majority of our products are not on Amazon. And a lot of people ask, like, well, how do you compete in this day and age of Amazon when you see, yes, e-commerce every year is growing, but a large portion of that growth actually just comes from Amazon growing. We find that, well, I mean, the best way to compete with Amazon is to not do so, right? And for the things that are on Amazon, we actually always have the best price. So you see a lot of other
folks.
You
know what? I'm sorry to interrupt, but it seems like I'm looking at just randomly HD1 over-ear wireless ivory. You guys sell them for $349. I guess Amazon actually, no, they do. They have it at $258.
Oh, do they?
But you know what? I take it back. That one might be certified refurbished, and that usually is a lower price. But what you're saying is, and I wouldn't be able to spend enough time doing research on this to confirm it, you're saying specialty products that you can't usually find on Amazon, yeah, made for people who want to hunt down the best product for the dollar, the yeah, ones who are going to spend the time going, that's your focus.
Yes.
I always thought the focus was different, that it was a fun place to browse for things you couldn't find anywhere else, and you could actually just buy them. Like, I'll give you an example. Right now on your desk, right now on the homepage is something called a smart stock tracking sculpture. It's basically like a seesaw with a bull and bear on one side. It has this classic vintage look, but also it's a modern thing that I can't imagine having existed 100 years ago. I'm never going to find it anywhere else. If I want something unique on my desk, that would be a place to go and find it. And if I just keep browsing through this, I'm going to come up with a bunch of different products like that. Was that part of the attraction too?
Yeah. So, I mean, in the beginning, that was the initial impetus, was what I had described earlier. And, you know, when you're looking to kind of cater to this group of people, right, who do the research, who are kind of at the cutting edge, and they're always learning about new things, you're also going to find things like that sculpture. You know, the products that are fresh off the Kickstarters to, you know, things that you would find at trade shows. And so it's, yeah, it is broader than where we had started.
Yeah, look at this. There's like this audio equipment that just looks so good that as you were talking, I just started getting distracted by it. I've been looking for really good speakers, something that makes my Spotify account sound like it's got a vintage record player feel, and that may not even be possible, but that's what's been attracting me. Okay, I get a sense of where you guys are coming from. I still don't fully understand how you got here. Let's go back in time and get to know you a little bit. You're a guy who grew up, you told our producer, an environment where you didn't have a lot of money. In fact, you couldn't even like buy your own toys. So what did you do growing up?
I actually made a lot of my own toys.
And really?
So, yeah, and I think this kind of, you know, from a very young age, you know, stayed through me even to adulthood. I still make a lot of my own stuff. And it started when, I'm not sure what exactly it was that I had wanted. I think it was when I saw the first three Star Wars movies, and I was really fascinated by the robots that they had, like the R2-D2, C-3PO's, and, you know, Darth Vader. And I couldn't afford the figurines, and a lot of my friends had them. And so I just started making them out of paper. First, they were kind of like pretty rudimentary, like made out of like loose leaf paper, but three-dimensional. Then I would kind of like add more and more detail. I'm going to keep making these three things over and over again until they got really detailed, had articulating joints, and they were just like,
wow,
like little 3D models that were made out of like construction paper that were like where I had actually kind of created this lamination out of it by stacking them and forming them. And so they got, you know, pretty detailed for paper models. And that, I don't know, the notion of if I couldn't have something, I would make it myself. It kept with me through adulthood. I you know, my career as an architect, and in school I would make these models. And then
I wonder why you became an architect. You're a guy who in elementary school, like I did, you discovered baseball cards and the ability to buy them low, or in one case buy them, get them for free and then sell them high. You had that entrepreneurial instinct. In high school you discovered the whole dot-com boom and you decided to jump in. Can you tell people what you did with the dot-com boom?
In high school, I think this was like around the web 1.0 days. I didn't realize that's what it was, but my father actually repaired electronics. So sometimes some people would drop stuff off and, you know, they would not pick it up or whatever. And after a certain amount of time, you know, it might take it back, right? And take it home, or if something was like kind of beyond repair. And if it was tossed out, sometimes my dad would even just find stuff on the side of the street and bring it home and try to fix it.
Okay.
And so we had our first computer, and, you know, our first internet connection when I was pretty young. And I just started, you know, playing on the computer a lot. And obviously, because I was a creative person, I started playing around with like Photoshop and Illustrator. And around that time, there was a site called SitePoint. I think they've changed to something else now. But back then, people would go on there asking for services like, oh, I need a logo design, or I need some kind of a simple website made. And I was like, well, this is great because you can do this without people realizing you're like a, you know, 16-year-old. And so I would make these logos and websites for people back then. And so that kind of started the little coding nugget too, because I actually every now and then would, you know, kind of freshen up and see what was new. In college, I actually coded too for my projects, because even in architecture, you know, for me, it was never about the glass and the steel and the concrete. It was always about how do you create an experience for somebody, right? No matter what that medium was. And so even as projects were often pretty out there. And I remember from my thesis, there actually was no actual building. It was actually a series of robots that are kind of based on Kivas, like, you know, the Amazon Kiva robots. And I would say, well, let's build this kind of collection of restaurants where all the components of the restaurants and everything that made up the walls and the environment were put on top of these robots. And then they would construct the space based on inputs from certain variables and people that are using the space. And so even then I was coding, and that was with Maya's kind of own language that they had, which is very similar to C++.
You went on to be an architect. One of your frustrations was that you would design buildings, but they wouldn't actually come to life, right?
Yeah. So around that time where I had, where I was practicing, it was a pretty bad time in the economy. And so a lot of times projects would kind of come in as just like a contest, or just as a, okay, let's just kind of make some design, and then it would never get funded, never go through completion. Also, even the projects that would get completed, I noticed that sometimes, like, you know, you have an idea and a theory of how the space should work, and oftentimes it doesn't, you know, pan out that way. But, you know, as an architect, you just kind of walk away. You never revisit it. You never change it. And you never get to, you know, iterate on it. And so I started picking up a book and started coding again. And then it was Ruby on Rails for Dummies. Back then there wasn't really like an incubator type of environment or a coding bootcamp thing out there. And so it was just a paperback book that would read on the subway, and then whip out my own laptop and code on during my lunch break or at night over the weekends and stuff.
So I heard you got it from the Strand, that bookstore right in downtown New York. I used to love walking through there.
Yeah, my office was pretty close by, so I would pack my own lunch, and after I ate it, because I eat pretty quickly, I would just go there and peruse the books. And every once in a while, they put out like these racks of used books for $1, and the front rack was Ruby on Rails for Dummies. I didn't even know anything about the language, or the framework rather, and I just picked it up, and yeah, it just so happened to be a pretty useful one. So
I'm pretty lucky. That's something that I don't get today in online bookstores. I read all my books digitally, and they're all similar to each other because I'm seeing the same thing, you know? I go to the same thing. Meanwhile, when I used to go to the Strand, I could just walk through there and spend spent a whole day, but an hour easily just walking through it, discovering books that I never would have considered otherwise. The price was kind of fine, so who cares? Just take it. And I'd end up reading things that I never would have considered otherwise. I kind of feel like in some sense that's what your site's about now. Touch of Modern is that kind of... There is a bit of that, right?
I mean, that's why people come to our site and our app, right? It's for that discovery aspect.
Yeah. And
that's really the thing that makes us the most different. Obviously, yeah, there's other sites out there that sell interesting products. Most of them in whatever specialty they're in, there isn't a place that aggregates it all. But the proof point of like, okay, yeah, we say we sell interesting products. What's the proof of that? The proof is that, you know, if you look at 2017, for all the people who've visited Touch of Modern at all, 45% of them actually come back at least once a week, right? And for an e-commerce, like, that's pretty unheard of. And
because it feels like a blog. It feels like a site where you're just kind of clicking around, you end up looking at earphones, and then before you know it, you're looking at underwear, and you say, you know what, this glow-in-the-dark underwear might actually be fun. Let's just get it. It's only $12.
Yeah.
Right? It seems like that kind of experience. Okay, so that's how you ended up with Ruby on Rails. Then you decided, you know what, I'm going to get into this whole startup thing because architecture is not allowing me to create. It's not allowing me to iterate. From what I understand, you got accepted into IO Ventures before you even had an idea. That accelerator just took you and a couple of your co-founders in. Am I right?
Yeah, actually, that original idea was started by the other three guys. I actually was not a part of that. I knew them when they were in New York, and I kind of had watched from the sidelines. So the way architecture works, it's a five-year program in school. And so even though I, you know, knew the guys, they graduated a year earlier, and I think, you know, they had already had that head start and had already been jaded by the brief stint in corporate life. And so they were on it. I had, you know, just got my job, and I was happy with it. I mean, I still was happy with it by the time I had left, but they, you know, I was still just kind of starting my new life, right? Or at least a little bit longer. And so they had started with that idea, and they had came out to San Francisco after being accepted into an incubator. And one of the co-founders there, Dennis, they actually just worked out of his mom's house in Union City, which is where our warehouse is now. Not at her house, but in Union City.
Okay. And was it true, though, that they got accepted without an idea? I think I read that in Inc. magazine a while back.
There was an idea, but that idea had changed pretty quickly. The original idea was called Skyara, which was a peer-to-peer kind of like marketplace for experiences, right? An example of that would be, say, I remember this one because I thought it was pretty cool. An Army Ranger would teach like a ropes course in his backyard, right? And the difficult part with Skyara was that it was a double-sided marketplace, right? You had to get somebody to offer an experience, which is a huge ask, right? It's not asking for someone for money. It's not asking somebody to just give you like an object. It's asking somebody to put a lot of thought into this kind of experience and then alter their life so they can offer this at a moment's notice, right? For example, like, you know, I'm sure there was something else going on in this guy's backyard that wasn't a ropes course that he had to turn into one, right? And then on the other end of it, you had to get people to come on this platform and book these experiences. And it's hard because you have this chicken and egg problem, as you do in other marketplaces, because why are people going to offer experiences when there's no one buying? And why would people come and buy them if there's not enough people offering, right? And so the solve for that was Raven, which is when I came on. I came on just before we had started that. And this was after they had raised their first seed funding after the incubator from Hillsvent. And that idea was, we took out one side of the equation, which was people offering experiences, and we went with experiences that already existed. And we just like amassed this, you know, huge supply of experiences across the US. And then we built this discovery and booking engine around it. And it was really interesting because it would learn what you would like on your interactions with the various things. So basically you would have this feed, which is actually not that different than our site right now, right? Which is this feed of cool stuff, right? It'd be a feed of cool activities. It'd be like, you know, skydiving, hang gliding type of stuff, or scuba diving, or even just really interesting tours or whatever it was. It would just be a lot of things that were going on in your area that you didn't know about. And people would go and they would go and discover them, but they wouldn't book because there just was no real incentive to, because at the end of the day, if they were interested in something, they'd pick up their phone and call the activity itself and then book through them. And when we had decided to shut that down, we actually got a lot of people that were saying, oh, you know, I just moved to San Francisco and, you know, this app really helped me get to know my city and find out how to get situated here. Right. Which I thought was really nice. But at the end of the day, it wasn't a good business for us, because each one of these vendors or suppliers, they were so limited just by their geography that there wasn't enough margin in it to spend on marketing, to, you know, hire a sales team.
Yeah. I mean, look at this. So I went back and I saw the site listed.
We had that Vagabond conversation about the speakers.
The site had Vagabond Indie Craft Fair Spring 2012. If I would have seen that on your site and thought that was kind of interesting, I just go. I don't need to register on your site and go. I just head out there and go. There are a couple of other things that I might need to buy tickets for, but I'll go, like you said, go to their site and buy tickets. I get it. Before we move on, I get the idea for Raven. I want to just kind of point out that Skyara was written up by Alexia Tsosis in TechCrunch, and she called it Airbnb for experiences, which I think is so interesting, because Airbnb now does have experiences that are so similar to what you guys did, but obviously they don't have the chicken and egg problem. They had a bunch of people who were coming into a new city looking for stuff to do. All they had to do was say to local people, why don't you do some kind of event in your backyard or a kayak and show people?
I think that they had a better cash cow to fund the whole thing, right? And for us, we just never got it started because financially it never made sense. And so by the time we started Touch of Modern, we wanted to make sure we stayed close to the transaction. And it wasn't like, oh, we can prove out the business model if we get to, you know, this incredible size, right? And I think a lot of startups were doing that because that's how Facebook did it, right? That's how a lot of these big companies did it. But we're not going to be profitable until we're just this huge juggernaut, right?
Right.
I think the reality is that most companies can't operate that way, and most companies are going to die before they get there. And you only hear about the ones that make it. That's just survivorship bias, right? So we were like, if you're going to build a company responsibly, because the reality is, you know, we're not a Facebook or whatever. We have to stay close to the transaction.
All right, let me take a moment and talk about my first sponsor. Then I want to come back and ask you about how did you guys feel considering the two ideas didn't work out? You need enough confidence as an entrepreneur to will something into existence. How did you have the confidence to do that after those two setbacks? Let me take a moment, though, and tell people that I actually had seen your office before. I rent from Regis, my sponsor, and I love my office here. I've said this before, that I love that the receptionist just mailed out VR headset to somebody in Australia, and I didn't even have to think about it. That I feel like coffee. They have coffee here for me. That I need a lounge area to get away from my desk. I've got that. I need high-speed internet. Got that taken care of. The whole thing. I did Scotch Night last week. Total space here just for me and my guests, people who I interviewed, people I got to know, to have Scotch. I love all that. It makes me more productive to rent from Regis. But sometimes I want to get away from my office. And Regis has all these other offices throughout the city, throughout the state, throughout the country, throughout the world, really. And so one day I said, you know, I don't want to be in an office. I want to go and experience some sunshine. Regis has an office that actually has a like an outdoor garden. I said, let's go work from there. I sat in their lounge when it was cold in the morning. And then in lunch, I went and I sat outside. And when I took the elevator from one floor to from the top floor to the bottom, I happened to see that your office, Touch of Modern, what's that whole area called? The one next to Whole Foods?
Whole neighborhood?
Yeah.
Potrero Hill.
Potrero Hill. I never even know this stuff. But I know that I can just ride one of the city bikes over there. It was a beautiful environment. Good lunch, good space, good vibe. I spent a day there and then I got back to my office the next day and I enjoyed it. If you're out there and you want to be more productive, you should know that you will be so much more productive if you work out of a Regis office, because they're set to give you that, to give you the quiet space where you can shut the door and work, to give you and your team high-speed internet, coffee, water, whatever it is that you need, space for lounges. There's a courtesy conference room when people come in and have a meeting with me, and so on and so forth. But you should also take advantage of the fact that they have tons of offices all over, some that are in the same buildings as some of the best companies out there. I know, because they only rent from, they only put up Regis offices in the best buildings. And so if you're looking to rent from them, go to Regis.com/Mixergy and don't just rent. Ask them to show you around. Ask them to show you 2, 3, even 5 locations until you feel the one that really will make you more productive. And that's the one you should rent from. And if you want intro to our people, someone this morning just emailed me and said, hey, Andrew, can you introduce me? And I was happy to do it. So here's the thing. Regis.com/Mixergy if you want to do it yourself and set up your time to look at their spaces and just see if it makes sense for you. Or contact us, contact@Mixergy.com, and my team and I will introduce you to our people that we work with at Regis. contact@Mixergy.com. Jared, did you feel like a failure? Did you feel like, hey, this is not going to work out? I'm sorry, investors, we failed you.
Yeah, I think that we actually said that exact thing to our investors. This was at the end of Raven. We were running down to our last little bit of capital. I think we had just maybe a couple months left. And we were maybe not even a couple months left. And again, we were in that living room and we had the idea for Touch of Modern already. But we didn't know if we should jump in with it. And I remember asking, I think John actually asked the investors what we should do. There were the few options, right? One is just give the remainder of the money back and, call it a day. Another one was we just keep on the path and then we run out of money. And the other one was, well, we have this other idea that we're really excited about. I'm not sure this is enough money to prove it. But maybe we should try that, right? And our investors actually said all three of those options are good because they had invested in the team and not the idea. And that when they had done so, they accepted the risk that all the money might go away. What would not be a good option is, just to pay ourselves the rest of the money and take off, right? There are horror stories out there, and obviously that one never had crossed our mind. But we were sitting around the living room, and we were all kind of weighing the options together personally. And I remember there was this article talking about entrepreneurs, and somebody was saying that, oh, entrepreneurs are not these crazy risk takers. They're actually just people with, with safety nets, right? That they have trust funds and that they're able to take these risks because they can always land on their trust fund or something. I kind of resented that because I'm sure there are people like that out there that are doing it, but that wasn't the case for any of us. And I remember us saying that, we all moved out here not knowing anyone and we just didn't want to go back. We were like, we can't go back. We would just be like hanging our heads in shame. And we were like, if we're going to go out, we're going to go out like swinging, right? And so Dennis started testing the new idea without even having website built yet. He would just start testing, user acquisition costs. And we just had assumptions for everything else after that down the funnel of what kind of metrics we needed to hit. And then we would just kind of prove them down the funnel. So he started with user acquisition costs, just running ads on Facebook.
You acquire an email address at a certain price point? That was the goal.
Exactly.
And then what would he offer somebody to in exchange for the email?
It was just a something is coming soon and a little bit about the story. And basically it was like, if you were that kind of early adopter person, you might give your email.
Right. I feel like, so I've seen some of the early landing pages. I'm looking at one right now. Daily sales of modern designs up to 70% off. There was beautiful furniture, the iPod, because this was 2012, not 2018, where you might have an iPhone. TV, I think, that looked modern. It was this really nice design. So they were giving their email address to get access to these deals, right? And it seemed like you were kind of going after the same, you know how those design sites were coming up, the fab.com that I think closed down and a few others? It seemed like you were kind of going after that energy. Am I right?
Yeah, a bit of that energy, but with a very different aesthetic. And I think that came from my architecture background because I had seen them and I really didn't like their aesthetic nor the way they were curating, right, their products. And it seemed like maybe they started off good and then over time kind of degenerated because, if product A does well, product B is kind of similar, and then product C is kind of similar to B, and then eventually it just kind of devolves to pretty average stuff, right? And so I had a different way of looking at it, and I thought that we could still stay fresh by kind of looking at all these products from an industrial design perspective and looking at them and kind of breaking down what is it about this product that actually resonates and how do we replicate that success rather than just bringing on kind of copycat products, right? And so we started off with that, and then Steven and I would build the first website, and Dennis and John were just hitting the phones, calling, you know, vendors of things that we thought were cool and saying, would we want to be a part of this? And that's how it started. And then we just kind of ran three test sales and just to prove out.
Once you have the email addresses, you're going to go to your site and offer some test sales. What's the first product or the first three products that you put on the site?
Oh, I don't even remember exactly what they were, but I remember there was a clock that looked like gears on the wall that would kind of tell time as they turned. There was some really kind of unique scissors that had like multi-functions on them. They were pretty much kind of like really cool home and desk objects, kind of the things you would find at the MoMA store. Those were kind of the first things we got.
Where did you get them?
Where?
Yeah.
Yeah, with just various brands. We would just call them up, and if we just be hitting like the blogs and design magazines and stuff, and just like, hey, like we think that's cool. We do our research, and then we'd find out who made it, called them with the idea, and just brought them on board. And we just did this out of our apartment. We actually shipped all these things ourselves from our apartment, and we pissed off the landlord.
I want to talk about the pissed off part, but let me just say that one of the things that I heard from you was that when you put the first products on the site, before you even emailed this list, because you spent a lot of time acquiring a list, before you even emailed it, you got a sale.
Oh yeah, this was the day before, the night before. We just turned it live for like a minute just to make sure a live order would go through, like outside of like a staging environment, right? And when it came through, we're like, wait, this is a problem. There's two orders. So wait, but the second order isn't even the thing that we ordered in the first order. And then we looked at the name and then we saw this is an actual person that just stumbled on the site and made an order within a minute. We were so excited about that because in our previous companies, there would be days that went by and not a single order would happen. And just in a few minutes, we got one. We're like, whoa, we hope that this is like a foreshadowing of the next day, right? Which is going to be our first sale day. And in the first sale day, yeah, we produced over $5,000, which is probably more than we had in the previous year. And then, you know, then it was another five, and I'm not sure what the third one was. And on the final sale day, we launched was like 10. And so that was it was clear that we had something there. I think in the previous companies, we struggled a lot. We often thought, well, this is just what a startup is like. You just struggle and you grind it out. And it was a struggle, you know, even after we started Touch of Modern, but it's a different kind of struggle because you have something to cheer you on, right? Which was that the revenue was growing, people were coming and visiting, people were buying. Right. And you could see like this could one day be a real business. It wasn't like just bleak kind of struggle.
Oh, that is exciting, actually. I get it. And so tell me if I'm understanding you right, if I'm following so far. The idea was, let's just see if we can acquire email addresses on the cheap. People would see your ad on Facebook. They'd come to your landing page. And this was a time when it was totally understandable for people to give their email address to get exclusive deals. Groupon pioneered it. Some of the design sites had done it. AppSumo in the software space was doing it. They gave you their email address. Your ad buys was good. You then started putting something on your site. Some random guy bought. Chance, it's not really proving your model or anything, but it's kind of exciting. More importantly, once you started emailing your list, they bought the things that you hand curated, you picked out. That's the thing. And when it comes to the ads, what were you doing that worked with advertising? I see that you guys are really good at user acquisition. I'm trying to get a sense of the background. What was it that worked for you in the beginning, or who was it who had the skills to do this of all the co-founders?
It was Dennis. And the thing is, he was always the biggest risk taker out of all of us. Mm-hmm. I think he always wanted to believe in the things that were new. And, you know, in his past, this was way, way long ago when I first knew him. He was actually one of the most, you know, popular bloggers on Zanga back in the day. You know, remember Zanga?
Yeah.
And so he was always in on like the ground floor of things. And so when we had started advertising, Facebook had just launched their ad platform. And I think Dennis saw something in that. I'm not sure like if he you know, could see where we, like, I'm not sure in his mind he already thought that we would be where we were today, but I think he just knew that this was something new and that, you know, maybe there were a lot of eyeballs on it, and he knew the power of social because that's where his past was. And he just gave it a try. And, you know, it wasn't like we did anything particularly different than what anybody would do advertising on Facebook nowadays, but we were just early. And, you know, a lot of the big competitors hadn't, you know, weren't on there yet. They didn't believe it yet. And so when you're in early on something that groundbreaking, you're just going to be able to capitalize on a very inefficient market.
Got it. So it's not so much that he had experience in advertising. I think his experience was in Wall Street. It was just that he said, this new thing with Facebook, it's got to work. I believe in us. Let's make it work. You did it. All right. You were starting to say that you guys started to take possession of the product in your house. You weren't drop shipping from China in your house. You were living in the Bay Area, right?
Yeah, we're in an apartment in the Mission.
In the Mission. Right. Yeah. They don't like a lot of things in the Mission. In fact, they don't even like anyone in tech to live in the Mission anymore. Yeah. What was the experience like when you suddenly had a bunch of stuff in your house and had to get it out? You got to tell people that story.
We just, like, our apartment was, it turned into a fulfillment center. It looked like a hurricane that came through there. And it was like just boxes everywhere. We were sitting on top of boxes. And I remember at first, the first sale we ran, we just kind of piled everything up in the lobby, and we got a ton of complaints because it was probably a hazard and, you know, at best it was an eyesore. And so the next sale we ran, we knew when the FedEx guy was coming, and basically we ran this kind of assembly line down the stairs. And so basically we would just, you know, get it as quickly from our apartment to the door faster than he could put it on the truck.
So to just make sure that nobody in your building saw that there were a bunch of boxes being shipped out of there.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Boy, so those must have been really exciting times.
Yeah, kind of like, you know, those old days when people, when those firefighters just passed buckets of water.
Yeah.
Our packages going to the FedEx guy.
All right, the first customers came from Facebook and that random person. What was next? What was the next big source of customers for you?
I mean, we continued on with Facebook for a really, really long time. Probably for the next few years, we were on Facebook only. And then we got Google to work as we got to a certain scale. I think you need, you know, a lot more products and stuff. It was a much more mature platform at the time. And so this is also why it'd be very hard for a new competitor to do what we did, because Facebook now is a mature platform like Google is, right? And so it's a lot more competitive, and you can't do it with just a few products the way we had done it back then. So when we got to enough mass, we got Google to work. And then probably the next biggest shift in marketing came from television. And that just happened last year. Now we're running, you know, ads on television.
You know what? Before we get to television, I saw something else as I was hunting through your traffic that I want to ask you about. But let me take a moment to talk about my second sponsor. It's a company called TopTal. Jerry, has hiring been an issue for you guys?
Oh, it's one of the biggest issues for us.
Really? What's the biggest challenge with hiring?
It's just finding great people, right? It's very, very competitive out here. And it's a big investment just to go through the interview process, to train folks, to get them acclimated. Then if they don't work out, you got to do it all over again.
Yeah. What's one tip that's worked for you before I get into TopTal and how they solve this?
One tip that's worked for us in terms of
hiring and dealing with all this, especially in this tough market.
Ooh, and you know what? You have to market yourself as an employer. I think that's like a quality shift. Because, you know, we market ourselves as a consumer product, but
right. Not
as an employer, and you have to do that work too.
When you do that, what's that like? What do you mean, buying ads?
No. A lot of that is going and, you know, actually even talking about your company as a, you know, in terms of a work environment. How do you think about employee growth, and how do you think about career tracks for people, right? Because that's a thing that you market. It's not just internal, but it's external as well. And then also attending things and hosting, what do you call those? Kind of like the hacker meetups and all that.
Yeah, at your office. Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. Really, if you're going to do it, that's the long game. That's where you really start developing relationships with people and hiring. So I had a listener, Greg Archibald. He's a longtime Mixergy listener, and he needed an experienced developer for his new business, Greasebook. Greasebook is software for oil and gas industry. He had a hard time screening people, hard time finding people. And when you're just getting going, it's a lot, like you said, a lot of dedicated man hours to do it. And then if you find someone and they end up going somewhere else, that's all wasted. You've got to start over. He realized that hiring local was especially tough for him. Hiring a recruiter was going to be expensive. So what he decided to do was go to TopTal. TopTal has an international talent pool already set and ready to go. They've tested them. They've screened them. They're all together in their database and all part of their TopTal community. And so he decided to give them a shot. And he knew that there was no recruiting fee, nothing to lose if it didn't work out. And he decided to focus on his business, go to TopTal. TopTal picked a few people for him to talk to. He ended up hiring through TopTal. And as a result of getting great developer, he ended up in an energy accelerator and his business is going well because of this. If you're out there and you're listening to me, the thing that got Andreessen Horowitz and so many others excited about TopTal as an investment platform, as an investment, is they said, hiring is super tough. Everyone's doing it the same. TopTal is going to do it completely different. First, screen people out, make it really tough for them to get in. So they're going to want to be in the system, have this big database of the best developers. And then when a company wants to hire, introduce them to those developers, and they could often hire them within a day or two. Really, Andreessen Horowitz loves them. I love them. I've hired from them. And now Greg Archibald is a believer. If you want to hire, in fact, you too, Jerry, and anyone else listening to me, if you want to hire the best of the best, these guys are really proud of their network of developers. Go to toptal.com/Mixergy. When you go to toptal.com/Mixergy, they're not only going to help you find the best developers out there, they're also going to give you 80 hours of TopTal developer credit when you pay for your first 80 hours. And that's in addition to a no-risk trial period of up to 2 weeks. Let me just emphasize this. You go to this page that I'm about to give you, you hit the green button, you talk to somebody on their team, you tell them what you're looking for. They then go to their network and they find 1, 2, 3 people for you to talk to. If you don't love them, you don't have to hire them. If you do hire them and you still don't love them, you will not be billed. And then if you do hire them and you do love them, which I found Mixergy people, that's the experience they have, they're going to give you 80 hours of TopTal developer credit after you pay for your first 80 hours. This is an offer they're not making to anyone else because they're longtime Mixergy listeners. They're supporting me and they've gotten really good results from our audience. So go to toptal.com/Mixergy. Top is in top of your head. Tal is in talent.com/Mixergy. All right. Here's the thing that I discovered. All right, Jerry, I dedicated so much time because I just am fascinated by your company, as you know. One of the things that it seems you do is you've got a partnership with Comcast where when people log into Comcast and see that Comcast website, you guys are one of the options for e-commerce on there. Am I right?
Oh, are we? I didn't know that.
Yes. So I guess you're at a place right now when you're doing $100 million, you're not on top of every single ad spend, right?
Oh.
So the evolution was Facebook ads were working, and then at some point you were hiring a team of people to do more ad buys. Is that right? Okay, and then the team of ad buys went to Google. Did you guys get into SEO, considering how many products you have?
You know what? I would say we're probably not the best at SEO. Doing a little bit of it, but I think it's an area that we can definitely improve a lot on.
Okay, so SEO wasn't. Did partnerships come next?
We did have partnerships. Partnerships are always great because actually they tend to be profitable channels that are often hard to scale up because each one of those partners is not as big as a partner as, Facebook or Google.
Right. And so you've got to spend a lot of time finding them, nurturing them, first of all, convincing them, working special deals with them. What are some of the partnerships that you've had?
Some of the partnerships that we've had.
What do they look like in the early days, especially?
Yeah, in the early days, we had just kind of, what would you call it? They would be like commissioned ad buys on design sites, or they would kind of write a blog post about us. And they would get like a referral fee, things like that. So it wasn't like a pay per click or pay per sign up. It was just a like pay for the exact revenue that you generate. And that was effective, obviously, because you don't have like that upfront
affiliate cost. Deals, essentially.
Yeah, affiliate deals, yeah.
And you guys would internally go after them one at a time.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Say to somebody, you've got good audience. We've got a couple of products that would fit for you, et cetera.
And then eventually we found that there were know, folks that can aggregate those things and do it for us.
Got it. Okay.
This is a small part of the budget. It's hard to scale that.
Yeah. Yeah. I get that. And I also see the value of it in the early days. What I'm curious about is the evolution of the product. It seems like you guys went from that hot design site to the site that can help you find things that especially guys would want but can't find anywhere else. How did the evolution of the product mix come about?
A lot of it was just trying new things, right? And so what's really great about our model is that every day we email our users with stuff that is, you know, cool and interesting. And they give us feedback by spending on it or not spending on it, or clicking on it or not clicking on it, right? And so we track these things of like, okay, maybe this got a lot of clicks, not a lot of revenue, or maybe this got a lot of add to carts, but not a lot of purchases, or maybe this did get a lot of purchases, right? And so we would take that and every day we would synthesize it and be like, you know, why did we think this did well? And then we would try and replicate that success and just keep testing based on that. And I remember we were doing like, we were finding early success with watches. And so we just started going higher end with them and that seemed to work. And then we started getting into vintage ones and then that seemed to work. And I was like, well, maybe, you know, people like the vintage thing. Maybe they like collector's items. And so we started getting things that were just kind of rare. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's kind of, you know, how we went first from just not thinking about that at all, just from, you know, design items to kind of iterating on it and getting to this place where we're a place for collectors as well.
Do you still to this day buy inventory, store it, and then send it out when you get a customer?
We usually don't buy inventory up front. Most of it is either, it's called cross stock, where basically we place like a bulk order and then they ship it to us and then we break it down and ship it out. And a growing part of it is also consignment, which they give it to us. We sell through what we sell through and then we send the rest back.
Got it. I see it. Yeah, I saw that you guys had a job listing looking for a new buyer. And I was trying to see what is the job of a buyer. And the thing that you guys were talking up, at least in the ad, was, do you want to see a bunch of cool things in person, experiment with them and try to figure out what's going to sell?
Yeah.
How much of it is actually taking possession of product, looking at it and trying to figure out, are your people going to get excited about it?
Yeah, most of it. That's probably the hardest part of the job, is to find these things and find the ones that resonate and can work within the model that we have, right? It's that the hardest part is the sourcing. It's not the closing. It's not the logistics of it. It is just the sourcing that is the hardest part.
Just going online, looking around, making calls, seeing what's going to work, making deals with them, that whole thing.
Yeah.
You ever feel like, look at these guys in the digital space. They don't have to do any of this. No possession, no shipping, no trying to figure out inventory.
Oh, we ship it.
What?
We do ship it.
You do ship it. I know. I'm saying that the digital guys, the guys at the SaaS companies don't have any of that. They just get to pick.
Oh, for sure. So, I mean, when we started with our first ideas like Skyra and Raven, we always actually liked the product space. And even early in those days, we would kind of fiddle with the idea that eventually became Touch Modern. But we never wanted to do it because we just wanted to sit behind a computer and we didn't want to touch real world things and move real world products and track things and, you know, do all that. But learning the struggles of the first two businesses and how difficult they were to scale, that were just fundamental to the business, we then realized that like the challenges with e-commerce were like known challenges. Like we could figure that out. They might not be like the sexiest problems to tackle, but there wasn't anything there that fundamentally prevented us from scaling as long as we can figure out, you know, the lifetime value to cost of customer acquisition ratio. If you can figure that out, like the other stuff will come.
And it does feel like one advantage you have over other e-commerce sites is you immediately ask for the email address, immediately ask for that long-term relationship so that if they come to the site and don't buy right away, there's still a chance to introduce them to the next and the next thing, right? You smiled as I said that.
Well, yeah, because it was kind of like that. Yeah, just the way you phrase it. It's like define the relationship moment right away.
All right. You were starting to tell me about television advertising. That's working for you.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of our products are just highly visual, right? And I think they just beg to be shown on video rather than just on an image. And so that we always had a hunch that it would work really well. And we've gotten to a size where it's a viable channel for us. And it's also huge. The inventory there is deep. People still watch a lot of TV. So it just works for us.
And I guess you hired an agency to figure it out, to test it, because you have so many products and such a data-based business that you did, right? That you've got to find the right fit. What have you learned about buying on television?
I mean, we're still learning every day, but the creative really matters, like the actual spot. I think that's actually probably one of the most expensive parts of it, is not actually the buy. I think, you know, the buy, I mean, advertising online is expensive too, right? But creating a visual that works online is a lot cheaper than creating one that works in television. So that's the hardest part. So you have to make sure each one of those counts. And so that's probably also why it's a later thing, because you need to iterate online with those kind of quick, cheap iterations first to kind of define your brand, figure out what you are. And then once you know what you are, you can go out with a strong message on television.
You know, so on television, do you still get someone's email address? Do you still start off with that?
Yeah,
you
do. The same way we measure online. It's direct. It's not like just a, we hope this works, we hope our brand is an elevated kind of thing. It's a, you know, we look at the signups that come on right after we air the spot.
Yeah, look at this. So I'm looking to try to figure out where you guys are buying ads. It's basically everywhere. You're buying ads on MSN.com, Yahoo.com, Facebook, AOL, Back China. You're using Display Network, like the ones I don't even know. Criteo, you guys are buying a bunch from them. I never heard of them. This is all me using SimilarWeb to get a sense of it. And one of the benefits of the way that you guys operate is it's not, hey, come to my site. Maybe you like this wallet. Maybe you don't. If you don't buy it, then I've lost you. It's come to the site, understand our value prop, enter your email address to immediately see all these deals. And if you don't buy today, which you probably won't, you're going to buy over time. And now you guys know the lifetime value of customer. This is brilliant. Okay. So you told our producer, things are going great. You keep on growing and growing and growing. But every time you start to hire, especially in bulk, things start to break. What do you mean by that?
Every time we go to the next state, right? It's scaling. I think as you hire more people, you yourself have to learn how to be a leader to those people, right? You know, we're not career executives and stuff. And this, we started at the bottom and learned with our company, and so. As the company goes through its stages, you have to shift your thinking along with it, right? The way you manage 20 people is not the same way you manage 120 people.
What's the difference? What have you learned as you grow?
So in the beginning, it is how do you get people to do the things you need to do, right? And so a lot of it is just like through sheer force of will, right? They're staying late because you're staying late. They're doing the things because you need them to do the things, right? And you can be there with them.
Right.
As you start growing, you might not necessarily be able to do that anymore, right? Because you are now a much smaller percent of the organization. And people are not looking to the executive team to know when they've done their job. They're just looking kind of across the table at me like, well, if this person's leaving, I'm leaving kind of thing, right? If this person feels like it's good enough, I feel like it's good enough. And so now you have to lead by creating a culture that leads itself rather than just saying, I'm going to be there, make sure everybody does the thing, right? And then as organization just gets older, your employees have longer tenure, right? And so when people are starting to hit that 1-year mark, the 2-year mark, 3-year mark, 4-year mark, what is their incentive to stay, right? Now you have to start thinking about, are they building successful careers here, right? That's one of the greatest joys for me coming to work is seeing people who started here, you know, on the first day that are still here, that find their career here valuable and feel like they've gained, they've grown, and that they're much more valuable in their positions out on the market than they were before.
Is there someone who comes to mind when you think about?
Our first employee is still here, Allie.
Who?
Allie, our first employee. She's
Allie.
Still-
What did Allie start out doing?
She started out as a buyer.
Okay.
And is now our director of merchandise.
So, okay. So now he's the person who's leading all the buying and leading also imagining the way that it's displayed on the site.
Yeah. She's, you know, helping out with new initiatives, anything that involves merchandising at all. She's there.
All right. I told you that your site is kind of fun to browse. If you saw me a couple of times kind of lose attention, it's because I was looking at stuff. Like I'm constantly hunting to test what you're saying to see what it looks like. And then on your site, I do that with every guest, but on your site, I then get distracted. So as you were talking about SEO, I went to see, what is their SEO like? What happens if I type in links, colon, touchofmodern.com? Then I end up on a SodaStream by an artist. I've never seen this freaking SodaStream. I love my SodaStream, but I like the design of the SodaStream. So then I start clicking onto that SodaStream to see what that would look like in my house. And then I realize we're in a conversation. I should get back into it. All right. For anyone who's interested, go check it out at touchofmodern.com. I remember hearing you guys on podcast advertising, and people there would talk about all the crazy stuff that they would buy. They wouldn't just say, here's a new advertiser, it's Touch of Modern, here's the crazy stuff that they bought. Let me ask you that. Why don't we end with, what's the most interesting thing that you have bought from Touch of Modern? Or that you have, if you didn't have to buy it.
You know, the interesting things that I buy, I'm not sure. They're just so personal, interesting to me. I'm not sure they'd be interesting to anybody else. But the flamethrower is probably one of the most interesting things that we've ever sold.
What is a flamethrower? I couldn't find it online right now. Oh, wait.
Yeah, we had just sold out of it, so we're probably in the process of getting more. But it's a little flamethrower you can strap to your wrist, and it just shoots out like a tiny little fireball. And it's perfectly safe.
I could have sworn that I saw that before. And I kind of know you guys as the company that would have the balls to sell that. This is like Elon Musk said this is possible.
Yeah, I was very hesitant about it for a while. I was like, it's got to be legal. Like, how do we know it's safe? It's like a little bit of flash paper that burns at a pretty low temperature. So even if it like hits something, like unless, you know, that thing also has a very low burning point, it won't catch on fire. I'm probably butchering the scientific explanation, but that's generally what it is.
Basically, we're probably not going to hurt anyone. We're probably not going to kill anyone, but it is the type of thing that really stands out.
Practice it safely.
I was hunting it down. I'd end up with a link and then it wouldn't go to the flamethrower. All right, I get it. Touchofmodern.com for anyone who wants to check it out. And of course, they've got an app that's doing really well too, partially because people just love to stare at these products. And I want to thank my two sponsors who made this happen. The first is the company that I've been renting office space from forever, Regis.com/Mixergy. Go check them out. And the second, if you're looking to hire, if you're really struggling, just give them a shot. What do you have to lose? Go to toptal.com/Mixergy. Hit that big button. You'll have a phone call with someone on their team. And you'll see if it doesn't make sense for you, don't hire from them. If they introduce you to people and you don't love them, don't hire from them. If they introduce you to people and you do love them and you hire them and it still is not great, they won't bill you. And then if you do all that and you work with them for a few months and you still don't love them, let me know. I want to make sure that I'm only introducing you guys to the best advertisers. My email address is andrew@mixergy.com, or I'm at Regis office right at the heart of San Francisco. Come tell me in person, 201 Mission Street, one of many Regis offices I work from. Jerry, thanks so much for doing this and congratulations.